I was there because they wanted me to be there. Like, they called me specifically, you know, there was a list of people and I was on the list and I'm the one that got the phone call. Like, there was never any doubt in my mind that they didn't want me there or they regretted their choice.
So Darren Steinbach joins the Dark Zone, an adventure racing podcast today. Darren is coming all the way from out west, so I appreciate his time reaching across continents and time zones to chat with us today. It is currently October 2021. And Darren, if I am correct, it just finished a 30-hour trip home from the Adventure Racing World Championships. Is that right, Darren?
Yeah, I believe it was actually around 30 hours. It was, every part of Worlds was an adventure, including getting home. Traveling with bike boxes is always exciting, but it was doubly exciting coming back on Lufthansa, we had to check them at every stage. We had a 15-hour layover in Germany, and, it was pretty stressful, but we made it.
What you always say in adventure racing, that there's the race to the start line, there's the race itself. And then there's the race home. So congratulations on your Adventure Racing World Championship experience. Can you tell us a bit about you, your team, how you guys did, and feel free to go on about the course?
So I raced Worlds with Team Bend Racing. They're a team here out of Central Oregon. Most people should know them. Old timers will know them as Yoga Slackers, but now we're Bend Racing, balanced by Yoga Slackers. They're not my normal team. I usually race with a team called Tower Racing, that's kind of spread out over the US, but I train with Bend Racing a lot, and I was their TAC in Fiji, and I was media for them in Patagonia. I've hung out with them in New Zealand before Godzone. So I was on the short list of people to call when things kind of went haywire before Worlds.
So how did they go haywire for Ben? How soon before the race did you get the call to go race?
Before the actual race started, it was, you know, a week, but it was like a day, maybe a day and a half before it was time to fly out. And I was actually, so there was two Bend Racing teams that have been racing over the last month. They sent two teams to Nationals, and then they were going to send two teams to Expedition Races, one to Expedition Canada and one to Worlds. And actually, a week before Canada, Jason called me and asked me if I would be his alternate just in case something went wrong. You never know going into Canada during a pandemic. Like, he could not pass his COVID test, or he could just be turned around at the border. Like, that happens all the time. So I was in Denver for work and started kind of mentally preparing myself for doing like a 3-day race in Canada, like getting my feet together and kind of like running my legs out a little bit to like make sure they still worked. But everything looked like it was going fine. And I flew back from Denver, and then I was photographing a swim run on Orcas Island in the Puget Sound. That's kind of my side hustle, is doing media for adventure races and triathlons and swim runs and so forth. I was on the ferry out to Orcas Island, you know, just perfect time to start losing cell signal. And I started getting calls from Chelsea about one of the team members that was supposed to go to Worlds being sick, and not being able to, not knowing if they were going to be able to actually make the trip to Spain and then race. So it kind of like shifted gears real fast from like kind of a maybe 3.5-day race, but probably not because everything was going to go fine in Canada, to like, oh crap, like Chris, the teammate that they were supposed to go to Spain, is an insane athlete. Like, he's this like crazy runner guy from Central Oregon who, you know, can put in miles and miles and miles, and all of a sudden he can't run a few miles without his heart rate spiking to like 160 and like having to take a 17-hour nap afterwards. So it went from like a maybe you'll race this week to you might be flying to Spain this week. And not just this week, but like, it's Sunday and the flights are booked for Tuesday. So it was It was pretty last minute and hectic. And then we're trying to, like, I didn't have cell service, so like I couldn't just buy tickets to Spain, and they were the tickets that they'd already had, the flights back had been canceled randomly. So they were already scrambling to buy tickets anyway. So luckily Dan just kind of took care of everything. But I still had to like show up in Bend to pick the team up. I didn't have a bike box ready because I wasn't planning on racing. Figure out all of my gear, which is mostly all together in my van. But like not race ready in 2 days, more like a week. You know, and just figure all this stuff out super, super last minute. And then since the plane tickets changed, I had to drive from north of, like, take the ferry back from Orcas Island, drive from Seattle to Central Oregon, which is like a 6-hour drive, pick up the team, and then do another 3-hour drive back to Portland. And we ended up spending the night in my van, like all cuddled together outside the airport, just to get on the plane Tuesday morning. So, and that all happened from like Sunday afternoon to early Tuesday morning.
So excellent synopsis of attempting to get to the race start. And for those who are learning about adventure racing, those who are just starting to dip their toes into the water, Darren's story is not an uncommon story, where we are a type of people who are ready to go at a moment's notice. But I will tell you that your adventure getting to the plane has exhausted me, and all you had to do is describe it to me. So I appreciate you giving that summary. So to recount, you thought you were going nowhere, then you thought you were going to Canada, and you ended up going to Spain.
That's a pretty good synopsis.
There you go. Very good overview there. And then you had to fly out of the Pacific Northwest across the continental US and then over to obviously make all the connections, get down to Spain. Did all your gear arrive in Spain in one piece?
Yeah, that was, oh man, thank goodness. Yeah, all of our gear arrived in Spain. It was all in one piece. On the way out there, we actually didn't have any trouble. All the flights went smooth. It was a little bit, you know, the paperwork to get into Spain and Ireland was a little bit confusing, but you know, it was just, you know, download the thing, sign it, or you know, get the QR code or whatever, and then show it to everybody. So overall, it was pretty easy. Not like, oh man, not like MRC, who had so much problems, and I think even Quest had a bunch of problems with gear. But thankfully, yeah, even though we rebooked last minute and it was a rush to get out there, everything showed up.
We were down in Ecuador this past summer, and my teammate's bike box arrived 3 days after we arrived. The good news is we were there for a week before the race actually started, so we had that lag time built in. But it's not uncommon for people to be going all over the place. There was the story several years ago from Patagonia where the race captain had to fly out of the host city to another city to get the boxes off the tarmac to fly the 4 bike boxes back, and they started the race the next day. So that's not an uncommon event. So I'm glad all your gear arrived in one piece. And who was Team Ben racing? Who were all the members on the team? You were there.
So for this race, it was myself, Chelsea Magnus, Dan Stodigal, and Lars Bukahave. Lars is a racer out of, he's from Denmark, but I believe he lives in Norway now. And he actually was on the team that just won the European Adventure Racing Championships like 3 weeks before Worlds.
That's a strong team, because if I remember, obviously Chelsea's being Chelsea. Chelsea Magnus, for the listeners, is a very, very well-known adventure racer out of Pacific Northwest, married to Jason Magnus, who was in Canada at this time. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes. So they separated for the purpose of the racing. Dan, for those who watched Eco Challenge, Dan had some pretty good airtime in Eco Challenge with his experiences. Then Lars is very, very strong. I remember the last time I heard extensively about Lars was his experience in Expedition India. I know that they had a tough go of it. They had a challenging experience in India.
Yeah. He has some interesting stories about, you know, evidently at this point now, Bend Racing is well known for racing in their underwear. I think in India they had even less on, because it was just like every few minutes there was a bathroom break, and they had a really rough time there.
India landed kind of hard on Lars. And so you were going into the race with that's a strong group of racers going into the race. How do you guys feel going into it?
So it was like, there wasn't any real secrets about the team strengths and weaknesses, and like that I hadn't been like Dan and Chelsea specifically had been just training like crazy people, getting ready for Worlds. And I, you know, my big races for the season were C2C and Exhibition Oregon, which I ended up not being able to do because of a knee injury from C2C. And like my next big goal was running the Timberline Trail around Mount Hood, which is like a 42-mile run, which I accomplished like the month before. So like all of my goals were race goals had been in the past, and I was just trying to maintain. And like I was working three jobs at the time and just trying to like get in when I could, so I wouldn't lose it before I could start my like winter training regimen.
And so from a training perspective, it sounds like Chelsea and Dan came to the race peaking for that race. And you know, and adventure racing is always kind of wild because these last minute teammate switches are not uncommon, right? An injury, mm-hmm. you call somebody. So they were peaking going into the race. Lars is just strong across the board. He's like superhuman in many ways. And then you were, had checked off a lot of your boxes, and then you were getting into, not that you were into an off season, but it was nowhere near as intense as you expect. And all of a sudden you're alongside them at the start line.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Yeah. So we had to change our goals and change the strategy. You know, Chelsea mentioned in the race report that like one of the main things was just to go smooth, because smooth is fast, and then keep Darren happy, which they did an excellent job of. And I even like, I kind of joked with him at the start of the race that it was a little bit intimidating. Like Chelsea, so I mentioned Lars had won the European Adventure Racing Championship. Dan this year has won the Washington 360 paddling race around Puget Sound, the human powered. Him and
Jason did it together.
Yep. Chelsea won the 24-hour cross country mountain bike national championship. And I was there also. So, and not to downplay my accomplishments, but they've just like really been on it this year, and it's amazing. So yeah, the strategy was like kind of take care of me and take care of our feet and try and keep going. And it was like, in practice, that's easy to say, but at the start of the race, you know, everyone still wants to race and go fast, and like you still want to be competitive. So it's hard to like really walk that edge. And the first two stages, we did a pretty good job of that, but it was still hard. I think Chelsea was a little cranky, she said, for the first day and a half, like trying to adjust to like the new plan. And I pushed too hard on the first two stages. Definitely the first 8 hours I felt lightheaded because we were going so fast. And so it took us a little while to kind of settle into the rhythm of our race and not the rhythm of the race that could have been if, you know, things had been differently.
Gotcha. And that's adventure racers, adventure racing requires that kind of on the fly adjustment as we go along. And sometimes those adjustments are major, selecting a new teammate, going into the event and flying across the world with that teammate, or during the race itself, looking at the map and looking at the course in front of you and then making a strategic adjustment during the race itself. Could you talk a bit about, for the listeners at home, talk about the length? Like, I know the first stage was a monster trek. Am I right about that?
Yeah, so it was 122 kilometers, about 75 miles, and it was mostly roads, either paved roads or double track, and just gobs of elevation gain. I mentioned that I had gone around Mount Hood like a month or two before, and that at the time had been one of my biggest, you know, runs, and this was double that in length almost, and double in elevation gain almost, and our packs were much heavier, so it was like, just even the first leg was just huge to get through. And we knew it was going to be kind of a war of attrition for that. And our plan, you know, was to go fast. And like I said, take care of our feet. And we actually planned in, I think, two or three foot care stops. And I think that made a huge difference for the entire rest of the race. Like the decisions you made in that first trek just absolutely rippled through the whole race, and you could see it in like the teams whose feet just weren't as good you know, and who were exhausted and who couldn't hardly walk at the end of the race or didn't even make it through that leg or the first half of the race.
If someone is an adventure athlete and they run marathons and do triathlons and they hear that the first stage of a possible seven day race was a 77-mile trek with elevation, they kind of just stare at their podcast player. They kind of have a tough time processing that.
Yeah, it's hard to put into context what that means. And I don't know how I could. I think in your podcast you had a week or two ago with, I think it was James or Richard.
Richard Sparks.
Richard. Yeah, he said it was three marathons basically back to back to back. And that's still not even a good way to describe it. I don't know if I can. It's like if you went to do the hardest thing you've ever done and then you just did it over and over again for anywhere from 24 to 36 hours and then you continued doing some of the hardest things you've ever done. It's just insane what the course was and like what we all asked our bodies to do asked our bodies to pull us through.
What kind of pace were you keeping that first stage? Were you to run? Were you to shuffle? Were you to jog?
We did kind of a fast jog, I'd say. Like we had pretty light packs on. It was just mandatory gear, but we were carrying a little too much water, and it was warmer than we expected. So we got out of town of that first town, and kind of everyone stripped down to their minimum layers, and we did hit it pretty hard. Like it wasn't a run, but it was faster than the shuffle. And we kind of decided as a team throughout the race, we weren't going to do the AR shuffle or the dead man shuffle. So we were either jogging or we were fast marching up the hills when it came to later in the trek. But yeah, it was a fast pace. I think we had planned on doing that 75 miles in 25 hours, which is a pretty quick pace. For that long, but I think it ended up taking us just below 30, I think, to do it. So we were a little bit over on our estimates, but wasn't too bad.
How did you do with the navigation?
The navigation, we did really well. I say we did really well. Lars and Dan did amazing. It's for US racers that have never raced in Europe, the maps are so much different. Like I actually feel bad for European racers that come over here and race our races because the maps are just like nowhere near as good. But we also haven't been a country for 2,000 years. So Lars and Dan switched off on navigation, and as the race got going longer and longer, they actually seemed like they switched more and more. And the maps were like very, very accurate 95% of the time. But the problem is that they were so detailed that as we go through these towns, it was hard to navigate through them fast. And Lars and Dan made it seem like it was nothing. They made it seem like the navigation was not there at all. And it was mostly, there wasn't a lot of route choices in the whole race. So it was mostly just, make sure you're on the right trail. If you're not, catch it quick and get on the right path or the right road or the right trail and keep going. We did have, I was actually just looking at the tracker, like 12 hours into the race, there was one of the main probably route choices. And it was either take a road that was maybe an extra 3 kilometers or go down bushwhack down a ridge to a river and then back up to the road. And there was some debate on which was faster and which wasn't. I can tell you mentally, it was wet outside. It was a little bit not stormy, but a little bit stormy when we went through. And I was very happy to be on road instead of bushwhacking at that time. But looking at the tracker there, I kind of tracked the four teams around us, and we actually probably made up not a ton, 20 or 30 minutes, taking the road around that extra 3K, and it saved on our feet a little bit and saved on our morale, I think. So,
and that's always the classic navigational challenge during a race is when you look at a map, if you can cut a corner, right? If you could go across something rather than around it, you have to weigh the benefit of going through the woods and through bushwhacking versus just taking the road around. And you know, it's challenging on a team when teammates have a different opinion about that. But that's why you have a lead navigator. And when she or he calls out the direction, off you go.
Yeah. And we discussed it like, I don't know, for a few seconds, just like, hey, we can bushwhack this way or take this way around. What's everyone think? Everyone kind of agreed to like that. As far, it was downhill on a road, like it was fast. Like there was no sense in wasting extra energy to bushwhack when we could just go around. And the roads on the map were most of the time seemed like they were better than you would even expect. Like a black dotted line was sometimes like a really good road. So it made it pretty easy to, as much as I kind of complain about how much road was on the course, cause it was, you know, in 130 miles of trekking, what, 115 of it was on the road. In that case, I was, you know, it made sense to be on the road.
Yeah, but there's no way you're going to cover that much distance over time and not have the roads be friendly.
Yeah.
Like 77 miles in a wooded trail system would just take forever. Just the trails, the routes, the rocks, the up and the down. Let me ask you a question about the intra-team communication during the race. And this could be not just about worlds, because one thing that you bring to the podcast, Aaron, is that you have a tremendous adventure racing experience. You've, besides your own racing, which is strong and prodigious in there, you've had the chance to watch a lot of racing going on too, where the media for the Patagonia Expedition race, as well as you with the TAC. And what did TAC stand for again for Eco Challenge?
I don't remember. Team. Oh,
we can make it up if we want. Team assistance coordinator.
Team assistant something. Yeah. Oh man, I'll think of it as soon as we stop recording.
And what the TAC did at Eco Challenge, teams of four went to Fiji to race that monster race there, and they brought along a fifth teammate, and their job was to take care of the team, be waiting in the transition areas, help with gear, shuttle things around. And so you've seen and you've raced and you have this depth of adventure racing experience. And a common question that comes up very often is the intra-team in-race communication dynamic. Do you find in your racing, and it could be about worlds or it could be about any race that you've done or just your breadth of experience, how much conversation do the top teams have during the race, or is it quick conversation, make a decision and go?
You know, I think it's so individual team to team. You know, I know that some of the very, very high end team, Seagate and them, they don't talk as much during the race. They don't talk at all in the transition areas, really. They focus on what they're doing, you know, maybe mutter a few things here and there and then take off. But out on the course, I think it's important to be as verbose as possible. And that's something everyone struggles with. You know, the longer the race goes, the more likely that someone's going to be struggling with that from time to time. I had problems with that in Florida with Tower Racing. We got tired and our communication broke down a little bit. And I've had problems with that in other teams where, you know, you get tired and you get frustrated and like everyone goes through it. And hopefully you can have it so not everyone's going through it at the same time. So there's, you know, some people are in a fine mood and can help pull everyone back together. But it's so big. And on the Bend Racing team, it was really big. Especially with me being kind of a wild card. Like I was in Patagonia with Chelsea and Lars, so I'm kind of familiar with what they're like, but I didn't spend a ton of time out on the course with them. It was, you know, it was in transition areas and moving through and trying to meet them up on peaks as they went by. So I didn't have a lot of time to like see how they act during a race. In Fiji with Dan, it was a little bit more, because they would come into the camp and I would take care of them. I always made sure that, you know, every time Dan came into a camp, especially after that first section where he just was in such a deep hole, it was like, have two packets of ramen and some coffee ready for him. The coffee they might not drink until they were leaving, because they usually had time to sleep. But like, you know, Dan would suck down the top ramen and then I'd make more for the rest of the team. And I kind of figured out like what they were like when they were upset and what boosted their spirits and what I could do to help. And so I was familiar with them in that. And then also, we're all, Dan, Lars, even Jason, myself, we're kind of we're acrobats, and I have trained acrobatics with Dan and Chelsea, and so that was also really helpful in like knowing that I could communicate with them, and that even when people were frustrated, like we still had a really open dialogue because we've done things together that, you know, high level acrobatics that gets frustrating when you can't do it. And it made it easier to know like kind of some of those limits and how to talk. I get in my head a lot when I race. I'm just in my head thinking about things all the time. And so I'm the one on the team that needed to communicate more. And I'm also the one that was going to have a rougher time as we went along. And so I needed to be able to communicate with that, with the team more. And that was something that I struggled with really throughout the whole race. But because we have this past, the struggle was not as obvious. It was like, instead of doing a great job of communicating, I just did a good job of communicating. And that is actually like a big improvement for me, you know, something I've been learning as I've done more expedition races.
Well, there was probably a pretty heavy mental load on you too, because as we talked about it, when one of the team dynamics is keep an eye on Darren, it's really hard it's challenging before the race when you're well-fed, well-rested, and we get going. When you're into the race and you're in a 77-mile opening trek, or you're cold, or you're wet, or you're hungry, that compounds over time. So like you said, you get in your head a little bit. Do you find that, what helps you with that the most? Has it been your race experience to work on that? Has it been feeding yourself well? Has it been trying to catch naps here or there? Has it been telling somebody you're getting frustrated? Like, and the reason I bring the question up, Darren, is you bring a wealth of experience and knowledge to us, as I've mentioned. For newer racers who are listening to this, they may struggle with the idea that you can go into a hole during a race and you can climb out of it and you'll do great. And you might even go back into a bit of a hole and you have that up and down feeling going on. What have you found over time has helped you with that?
Mostly just racing with a good team, but also remembering that you're out there because you love something about what you're doing. You know, maybe you don't like the course, but you love your team, or maybe, you know, maybe you're not on the stage that you like, or that's your weak stage, but you're going to get to a better stage. And like, and just remembering why you're out there, and that the people that are out there with you want to be there with you. They chose, like, you guys chose each other. And also, you know, having the experience, like, it's one thing to say that until you've done it, it's hard to know, like, really in your heart that you could crawl your way back out of something like that. And I experienced that during the race a couple of times. On the first bike stage, the second stage of the race, I dug myself into a hole and I had to dig myself out. And then when I got shin splints on the middle trek, I had to like kind of dig my way out of that. And the team helped a lot with that. And also just reminding myself every step of the way that I was there because they wanted me to be there. Like, they called me specifically. You know, there was a list of people and I was on the list and I'm the one that got the phone call. Like, there was never any doubt in my mind that they didn't want me there or they regretted their choice.
And that's great stuff there, because you hit on so many things that are important for adventure racing. And, you know, in adventure racing too, we say a lot, is really the study of human dynamics, right? How we get along with each other, how we work together. And you said something really important there, that you remind yourself that you chose to put yourself into that situation. And by choosing to be there, that takes away your ability to complain about it somewhat, right? We all get to carry on a little bit, right? I was in a race this past summer where there was a 15-kilometer downhill trek that was added on because they had to change the course. I grumbled most of those 15 kilometers because I was on a road walking downhill, which just eats my feet alive, eats them alive. And so you're right about that. And you're right about your teammates and why you're getting to be there. And the fact that they reached out to you and they invited you to be there, so they knew that you would bring value to the team.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, it's easy to forget sometimes. I forgot that a little bit during the paddle, that I had information to give, they specifically told me that I was out there because I brought value to the team. And I think that's, you know, people listening maybe should take that. And if they don't tell their teammates that from time to time, it might be a good thing to remind each other, because even on my own, like the normal team I race with, Tower Racing, I maybe like, we don't tell each other that enough sometimes, and that there's a reason why we're a team together. And it's not just because it's just not random. Like, I didn't just meet someone on the internet and then decide to race with them over and over again. I met someone on the internet and they brought a lot to the team. And so now we race together.
So how did the race progress? So you had the big long trek. The trek went into a mountain bike, which went into a paddle. Am I right about that? Walk me through the race a little bit.
Yeah. So it was the big trek, and then a mountain bike stage that started at the top of a ski lift. And then went into a pretty big kayak, a 90K, about 55 mile kayak that had a 10K portage in the middle of it. And that was kind of a nice recovery stage. I think maybe we could have hit that a little bit harder, but we did fine. The portage was actually a nice breakup of it. It's a long time to sit, especially in those stupid sit on top kayaks.
Yeah. Bathtubs.
Yeah. Man, I hate that. Like in a world championship event, like that's what we're using. Yeah. We had seats that had backrests on them. They worked okay. Yeah. You know, it was better than nothing. And we had kind of some, you know, some padded seats in the front and some, you know, we had our snacks easy to get to. And then for the portage, we had some, one of the Spanish teams helped us out with a tether, cause we had forgot to build them for it. So it was a pretty comfortable kayak for being 90K.
When I speak with adventure racers, I ask them to talk about their favorite disciplines. Rarely is the paddling the favorite discipline.
See, and that's, it's so unfortunate. Paddling is right now my strongest discipline and one of my favorites. You know, coming into the race, I had been paddling more than doing anything else, really. I have a surf ski here in the gorge, and I go out on the Columbia River and, you know, a paddle for anywhere from a half an hour to do intervals, or go out with a group and surf a little bit, or on the weekends do a couple hour paddle from time to time. And so I was feeling really good on the paddle, even though I didn't have a wing. I had just a whitewater four-piece paddle. I still felt really good on it. And that's like, that's one of my big, and that's one reason why no one else probably cares too much, but that's one reason why I wish we had a little bit better boats for big events like this, because I want to enjoy, like, you know, I have a several thousand dollar mountain bike because I want to enjoy myself as much as possible on the mountain bike, which is my second, well, tied for my favorite, or my second favorite discipline, you know, and then we get in a $200 kayak that, like, most of the people's paddles are worth more than the boat.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a little frustrating, but everyone else has to do it too. So it's not like there's like a big.
Yeah. And that way it's a fair fight in that way. Everybody's using the same challenging equipment, but it's still, but to your point, if someone was a very, very advanced mountain biker, right. And they enjoyed going downhill. If they got to a race and they were handed a $89 Walmart Huffy, they would be kind of frustrated. That was the bike that they had to get on top of.
Yeah. It would be a different type of enjoyable. It'd be like, how can I take this challenge and make it fun, instead of how can I just like smash this mountain bike?
I heard the portage was interesting for some teams. Some teams forgot their trolley wheels. Some people had two boats on there. But I think, am I correct that you had some tough weather during the mountain bike section, the ski lift to the top, cloudy and rainy? Did the weather turn on you a little bit?
A little bit. It was pretty cold at the start of the mountain bike for us. And, you know, just sitting on the ski lift, I think it was, you know, just above freezing up there. We got pretty chilled going up there, and we had, I don't know exactly how the zip line worked, because Dan and I took off for the downhill section. But so Dan and I got on the ski lift, went up to the top of the hill, jumped on a downhill mountain bike trail, and then took that down to get a checkpoint, got back to the bottom, and then rode the ski lift up again with the rest of the team to the top. And once up there, like, yeah, it was pretty, the weather wasn't too bad. It was just misty, the like real thick mist that kind of like turned into rain as you were riding through it fast, made it so, you know, my glasses were basically impossible to use.
Yeah.
And it was a little chilly, but as far as I remember, that wasn't too bad. We didn't have trouble with the mountain bike until more towards the end of it, in the middle of the night. And even that was like, not because of the weather. We actually, for, you know, Dan and I are both big dudes. And Chelsea is small, and Lars is kind of like, you know, you put Lars next to Dan and I, he looks small, but he's just a normal size human.
Right.
And so Dan and I both run pretty hot. And so we and me specifically had more of a hard time keeping cool during the race than I had getting too cold.
Yeah.
My feet got a little cold on that mountain bike section, but like not enough for me to even really remember it.
Yeah. For the folks at home who are looking at their radios, I think that you and I probably have the same body frame, and I struggle much more with heat than I do with cold. Yeah. That's always been a very, and I have teammates, it's the exact reverse. Usually it's the folks on the smaller side with less body fat. The cold just goes right through them. Not so bad here. We all bring our skills and our benefits to the experience. So you head off, you have the paddle, you have the big monster paddle, the Trek. I heard that some teams, like I said, struggled with their portage wheels and they didn't make the tether. You mentioned you had a challenge with the tether, dragging the boat behind you. And you mentioned the Spanish team helped you out. Once again, folks at home are kind of surprised at how teams kind of lend a hand during races.
Well, and that's like, oh man, that was one of my favorite parts about even going to Worlds is like, and really going to any adventure race, but I get to go see all my friends. And that's another reason why I love photographing races too, is I'm not getting to race because, you know, too many races a year can burn me out. Mm-hmm. But I still get to go hang out with all my adventure race friends. It was like... One of the Spanish teams, I can't remember the name now, but the female on their team was Erin Hattelstead. It was a gal I used to race with here in the States. All the American teams I knew people on. The Spanish team I mentioned that helped us out with the tether. I didn't write down their name. I can't remember. But Danny, the gal on their team, she raced in Expedition Oregon with Quest, and she was in Fiji, and her and Lars are really good friends. We have friends from all over the world that we get to see when we come to these events. So we mentioned to the team that Danny was on that we didn't quite have like the strap setup we wanted to towing the kayaks. And they like, we just thought they were going to like, we were just going to get like one of the normal buckle straps and, you know, like basically a toe strap and it'd be fine. And they came out with like these, like the next day they brought like a strap with like elastic, like loop on it so that you could put it over your shoulder. And it was like way more elaborate than I expected it to be. So, it was really nice. And that's kind of the way it goes. Everyone there kind of helps each other out. And our team specifically, we kind of wanted to be known as one of the friendlier teams. Like we're one of the, well, I should say we Bend Racing is one of the top teams in the States. And when we race other people, we want them to think of us as like a nice team that helps people out. And that actually ends up paying dividends when you need help yourself.
I think you're spot on. You talk a lot about the idea of the adventure racing family, right? This is a unique sport with unique people. And we don't get together all the time. So when we get together, it's the great experience of getting into the race course during the setup, seeing everybody. You're making new friends, people you've never met before, and you're seeing old friends who only come together for these, there we call them family reunions from time to time, where we get together at these big events. And then on top of that, too, the fact that you were an American team, and Bend is a very, very well-known team in the adventure racing community, ranked at the Worlds. Jason and Chelsea are very well-known. There was the Eco Challenge bump where they were profiled rather extensively. We got to see Dan in his underwear, probably far more than anybody wanted to, but Dan was there for that for us. We want to leave our new friends and people we run into with a good taste in their mouth about the kind of people that we are. And that was a very common, and that's just the way it should be, right? You want to be a decent person when you're representing yourself and your country.
Yeah. And you can do that and still be competitive, you know, especially, you know, we want to be competitive in the race itself. And then plus there's always, you know, we really wanted to like get ahead of Quest and stay ahead of Quest. And on that big trek, we saw them about not even halfway through, I don't think. I don't remember. We saw Quest and like we ended up passing them and not seeing him again, which was great. Except for then, we worried about him at every TA. Not necessarily that they were catching us, but also Dusty had a bad infection in his leg, and we wanted to make sure that like we wanted to be ahead of him. But we want to be ahead of him because we're out racing him, not because Dusty's injured or Scarlett's feet are acting up or Matt's legs are hurting. That's part of the race, but you know, we want it to be
Yeah,
we want to compete against them, but we also want our friends to be healthy.
You also want a fair fight, right? Yeah. Exactly. So you mentioned you had some shin splint issues that popped up during the race. What, besides your specific situation, where did Ben have a tough time during the race? What would your team low point be?
That's hard to say. There was a couple low points. I think actually when I got shin splints on that middle trek, we had been on a trail and had, you know, it was the one of the few trails we'd been on in the race, and we had kind of slowed down a little bit. And then when we got back on the road, I slowed way down, and I hadn't really, like, I knew I was going slow because it felt like death every time I lifted my right leg up. But I didn't realize we were going quite as slow as we were. And we kind of had to have like a, you might call like a come to Jesus moment, where it was like, we need to like figure this out now. And so that was kind of a low point. I know that like Chelsea was a little stressed about making it through, and everyone did a really good job of not putting too much pressure on each other and on me. But at the same time, it was like, it was kind of one of those things where we needed to figure it out, or we weren't going to be able to like carry on through the race.
So it actually got that serious. It got to the point where the challenges you were having were risking the team's entire experience.
Yeah. You know, we were more than halfway through a 40-mile trek. Maybe we had 15 miles left to go, but we had slowed to like, you know, 1 or 2 miles an hour. And so, you know, we went from having 3 to 5 more hours left to, you know, having, you know, 10 hours left possibly. Yeah,
and you just start to bleed time. It's amazing how quickly time passes during a race.
Yeah. So we had to kind of like stop and figure it out and figure out how to get me moving faster so we could actually continue on. And I'm like, was actually pretty proud of myself for, I don't want to like pat myself on the back too much, but you know, with a little bit of help from the whole team, we were able to get me going. And we actually came back pretty fast. It was probably within a half an hour of like figuring out that there was a problem, where we were back going at a reasonable clip. You know, we still weren't running. I don't think we were going to run the rest of the race, but it was, you know, from 1 to 2 miles an hour to, you know, back up to like 4 miles an hour, which is, you know, it's a pretty big difference.
If you're doing 15 minute miles that far into a race, you're moving. Right. That's higher than the average team speed, I'm sure, on the other teams that we're seeing. And credit to you. And we talked about this in earlier editions of the podcast. It came up maybe in episode 2 or 3. We talked about that interesting dynamic where during a race where I don't want to gender, you know, make it too much of a gender thing, but men very often have a hard time asking other people for help. And the idea of giving gear to somebody else to hold and taking someone and admitting the fact that they're hurting, and then trading some of their gear away, letting the pack get lighter for them, and accepting the guidance of others, that's very often a challenge for many people during a race. And I've heard that time and time again. And so credit to you for letting that happen, because by letting that happen and by working with your teammates on that and not, you know, dying on that hill, you were able to pick the average speed of the team right back up. So in reality, your individual decision actually was for the team benefit.
Yeah. And that's, you know, I kind of went into the race, I try and do it no matter what, but especially this race where I, you know, it was very obvious what the team dynamic was, that but basically whatever the team said, like my job was actually just to say yes to whatever the team said. So if the team says, can I take some of your weight? The answer is yes. If the team says, can I put you on tow? The answer is yes. You know, if the team says, are you feeling better? You know, can you take some weight? That's a, you know, self-assessment. And if the assessment goes well, it's a yes also. I've seen those issues before, and I've even resisted some of that stuff before as much as I try not to, but in this race, it was not even a question. Like pretty early in the race, I had weight taken from me. Chelsea put me on tow, and we just like went to beat hell. Like she was so strong during this race. She had both Lars and I on tow, not at the same time, but like for a while we alternated, when we were both having issues. And so, yeah, so when it came time to rally and, you know, and talk about, you know, one of the things we did was we had some codeine with us that was our like, oh shit, emergency pills. And this was a situation where like, I was in excruciating pain. If I was going to go forward, it was going to, you know, I definitely needed help with that. And I've never taken codeine before and I was nervous about it. So I talked about it with the team and, you know, talked about what the dosage was and what the risks were and what the idea was behind it. And then I ended up taking it. And between that and kind of tying up my foot so I didn't have to lift it up every step as much. And Dan's pep talk, like that's what got me going again.
So what was Dan's pep talk? Let's back up a little bit. I don't want it to be private team confidential messaging. No. So don't get me wrong, but we'd love to hear that.
Yeah.
What did he say to you?
He reassured me that again, this is going to sound a little bit like trying to puff myself up, but like that was what the pep talk was. And it was the reality is like, he said that, you know, I was an amazing athlete and that I was around other amazing athletes and that I'm worthy to be there. And that the team wants me to be there and wants us to move forward. I don't remember all of the, you know, all the bullet points of it, but it was essentially like, you are amazing. We're amazing together. Now let's go. Like, you just have to decide that that's the case and we need to move forward. Because if you don't decide that, if you don't believe that you are, you know, an athlete that is of a high caliber that can move forward in the world championships, then we're not going to move anywhere. So it was pretty inspiring. Like I was already on board with like with team, let's go fast and make it to the transition area. But I was happy to hear the speech and you know, and be reminded that like that, yeah, like I deserve to be there as much as everyone else. And I do have the ability to keep moving if I can pull myself through this hard spot.
And it was the right words at the right time. And therefore, that's what you needed to do. And you were up against a cutoff at that time.
Well, I didn't know none of us really knew when the cutoff was. And I don't even know how close we were to it. I don't think we were actually that close, but it can sneak up on you real fast if you're not moving fast.
And what day of the race was this happening?
Well, so let's see. It was it must have been the fourth day of the race.
And how many days total did Ben race?
We were out there for 5 days and 17 hours.
Wow. Great. And for context, it was a 7 day race in total, right? So you were 5 days, 17 hours. And at that point in the race, having gotten that far into the race, where were you in terms of your sleep? What was your team sleep strategy?
Team sleep strategy was, I don't remember exactly what the plan was from the start, but essentially it was do whatever we can to make it to the hotel at the end of the first kayak, without too much sleep before that, because we knew we were going to get, we had 6 hours in the room, which we weren't planning on taking, but we knew it was, if we could push that far, we would get 3 to 3.5 hours of really good sleep rather than, you know, whatever 40 minutes of really shitty sleep in the TA. So we did end up sleeping at TA 2 between the bike and the kayak. I think we had 40 minutes of what was for me really horrible sleep. I've been having a issue where I can't tell whether or not I'm asleep. I don't know if I'm dreaming about the transition area or if I just keep waking up or whatever it is, but like if you were to tell me that we were there in that transition area sleeping for 40 minutes and that I slept, you know, 2 minutes of it, I'd believe you. I think in reality, I slept 20 or 30 minutes. It just didn't feel like it.
I think the only reason why we call what happens in TA sleep is we don't have a better word to describe it. It's not sleep. It's not moving, not really awake and not really asleep. It's that weird in between sort of time. I find when it doesn't always in the race, you come charging in and you're caffeinated or you're not, and your stomach's full or it's not. To go from movement to no movement is really hard, right? And it's tough to get going. But you're right, there was definitely that time in the TA that you were kind of asleep, kind of not asleep, which was enough to rejuvenate you.
Yeah, it was enough to get me going. And actually, like, it took me pretty far. Like I said, we were trying to make it to that end of that kayak, and I made it pretty well. Lars had a hard time. We got to like the last landmark on the paddle which was a, you know, a bridge that we had to get to. And then it was another, you know, I think maybe a couple kilometers to the transition area. We made it to that bridge and Lars just couldn't stay awake anymore. I was singing to him and like trying to remind him to paddle, and his body was still making the paddle motion, but nothing else was there. And he says he doesn't remember any of it.
Yeah. I've done the late in the race paddle with my eyes shut idea. How's that going to work out? And then you wake up and you're heading towards the shoreline.
Yeah. And I think if I hadn't have been in the back of the boat, I would have been in the same position. Cause that's that rhythmic sound of the paddle and the, you know, the floatiness of the water, man, that'll put me to sleep every
puts
time.
Right out. Exactly. Exactly. And then, so then you came through your tough spot, right? And your team rallied around you, and you had things with you to help you along, and you wrapped your feet up and you got the pep talk, and then you made it to the TA, and that led into what was next after that? After that, was that back on the bike?
So after that hard, moment, that was on the second trek. And so all we had left was the short kayak and the trek after that.
Gotcha.
And so we came into the TA, we actually, once we kind of got closer to town, Chelsea navigated us into town. We stopped and got some ice cream to kind of lift everyone's spirits. And I was still having a little bit of I was having a tough time in a different way. But when we got into town, all of a sudden, like my shins felt good. Like I felt really good. And then I had kind of a weird, it's kind of like a weird guilt for having felt bad, which doesn't make any sense, but you know, I was sleep deprived. It was a very emotional experience. And so I chatted with Dan a little bit about that. I really leaned on Dan a lot, emotionally for this race. And so it was nice that he was there to like kind of listen to me whine about feeling good.
Yeah, he's a future guest. We actually had an appointment to speak several weeks ago, and my schedule fell apart last minute, and Dan and I were trying to come back together. He, to me, and this will come up during his podcast, I'm sure, he feels like the kind of guy that he is just a enthusiastic, we could do this machine. Like he's there for his teammates and he brings everybody along. That's the vibe I hear about him, which is a great thing to talk about out loud, because maybe someone listening on this podcast can be that person for their team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's a super important role, and also like a fine line, like to be able to like keep people stoked, as much as possible without going over the top, which happens from time to time. And then also being able to like, when things go bad, not go too deep, you know, just like we all try not to like go too deep into our holes. It's important if you're way at the top, and you're the one bringing the stoke to everybody. When you go way into the bottom, it can be in danger of bringing people down. And it's hard to have that pressure on you as well. Like, you know, like that's not really very fair, but
if you're the person who tries to be a bundle of energy all the time, when you're no longer that bundle of energy, it sends a signal to the team that things are falling apart.
Yeah. So, and Dan does a really great job of like, he has those peak moments, but for the most part, he's like evenly high stoked, and then when things drop off, but it actually took me a little bit sometimes to tell when things had dropped off for Dan, but just like everyone else, he has his tells, and it was actually pretty easy. It wasn't like Fiji where he got in such a deep hole that it took days to dig out. He always got into these little tiny holes. I think he's learned a lot in the last couple of years about that, and so it was easy. Well, it seemed easy for him to come out of them.
When I speak with people about Fiji and Dan's experience in general, and it was a fascinating watch, people who don't do adventure races are amazed that someone who could be that gutted so early in the race could bounce back so strongly later in the race. Like they have no concept that you could recover in an event and actually do better following something like that, which is something you learn only by adventure racing. You could go into those lows and come out and be back at those highs and then be steady the entire time.
Yeah. And it can be a skill too. It's still difficult. Like I had a hard time when I was on tow on the trek a lot of times the idea when you're on tow isn't necessarily to keep pushing, you know, it depends situationally, but like sometimes the idea is you need to recover. So let the person actually pull you a little bit so that you can bounce back and be stronger for the team rather than trying to keep up and just keep putting yourself into a hole. And I struggled with that a little bit at the start of the race when Chelsea was towing me, trying to figure out whether or not I was in a hole and needed to like really let her pull me, or whether I just needed like a little bump every once in a while and someone's feet to follow. There's a lot to be said for like just having someone's feet right in front of you and you just stop thinking about what you're doing and put your foot down where their foot was.
Yeah, we saw that when we were in Ecuador climbing these pretty steep mountains in this beautiful, beautiful country. And during those really, really hard times, I would just look at my teammates, the backs of their feet. And I would just have my head down and eventually we're going to get to the top. And I didn't look past them. Like if I could follow that person's gait for as long as I have to. And when I get to the top, then we're going to be okay. And eventually the top arrived. If I looked up and if I saw how far away it was, it would have killed me. It was about what was right in front of me.
Yeah. There's no such thing as an infinity hill. And it's important to remember that. But it's also sometimes not great to look at the top and see how far away it is.
So take us through, though. It sounds like you're getting near the end of the race. You're on the paddle and you're the final trek in. So walk us through your finish. How did it go?
It went relatively smoothly. It was the kayak in was, we actually kind of made a little bit too big of a deal about it. I think we ended up, we hit the kayak at low tide as it was starting to come in. But we're all strong paddlers, so we were able to overcome the incoming tide like pretty significantly. We did end up pulling off on a little island to kind of take a little 20-minute nap and let actually more water come in, so we would have more room to kind of navigate the waterway. And so we pulled over, the water came up, the boat started kind of floating away with us in them, and we got going again pretty quick, and paddled out to the bridge that was before the main bay. And we stopped there for 30 minutes or so, kind of like eating, because we knew we weren't going to be able to eat probably while we were paddling across the bay, and kind of deciding what path we wanted to take. We could kind of go up the coast that was on our right and then head in, or we could kind of try and split a break that was happening. There was a break kind of maybe 2 kilometers out, and it would, you know, there'd be some pretty good surf, and then it would flatten out, and then the break would come up again. So there was a space where you could shoot out through there, but we ended up deciding that that was probably not the smart way to go, and we could just go up the coast and bounce over. And so we got out there and got that, and it was pretty non-eventful. We just paddled across. We probably could have paddled a little bit quicker, but we didn't need to. And Dan, once we got out to the bay, Dan was in the back of the boat and Chelsea was in the front, and Chelsea still has some tendonitis left over from Expedition Oregon. At one point she had what looked like a baseball coming out of her, at the top of her arm from the paddle in Expedition Oregon. So she's still kind of recovering from that, even though that was several months ago. So Dan paddled and Lars and I paddled, and we all just kind of motored on over. Dan's such a strong paddler that, it was easy for Chelsea to just stop and relax a little bit. And we got to that transition area, transitioned reasonably quickly, and then went in and got some few supplies from a store. We got some mouthwash because our mouths were pretty destroyed at that point, and a couple snacks, and headed out on the coast steering trek. And then again, this is where like Lars and Dan together just absolutely nailed the navigation the whole time. And we got on this coast steering section. It was more of a traditional orienteering map, rather than what you might think of as a map for, you know, normal adventure racing map. And that just, there's a lot of detail. There's a lot of coloring for the foliage, and it can be a little intimidating. And Lars really, really went after it. And pardon me. And just absolutely nailed the navigation. He might not say so if you ask him about it. There was a couple small little hiccups where we went, I don't know, 50 feet and then turned around and took a different path or something like that. But he caught everything extremely fast. And walked us to almost everything. The hard part for me in that was my shin splint started acting up again. And it had been, I don't know. It had been long enough for the codeine to wear off. And the pain that I thought had kind of relaxed a little bit started to come back. And so we had to address that. And then I started to really be affected by sleep at that point. I had felt like I'd done like a pretty good job staying awake. And even with our short sleeps that we'd had, had been able to push on pretty well. But the last trek really started to get to me as we got into the night. We were able to see the sunset on the coast, which was amazing. But it meant that we were, as it got towards, you know, 11 o'clock midnight, we were still coasteering. And
that's rough because you're down by the water. It's rocky. It's rooty. It's wet. And you're going into another evening, right? The sun goes down, because we all know that when the sun goes down, teams slow down, attitude struggle. And so that had to be hard.
Yeah, it was pretty tough. And we kind of all, like, we actually had a, it wasn't very long, but we had a moment there where, like, all four wheels fell off and, like everyone kind of fell apart all at the same time. But at this point, we were, had been doing a really good job of managing it. And we actually bounced back for having, like, the whole team fall apart. That only, I would bet that that didn't last 20 minutes. And we kind of, like, enough of us pulled our shit together that we were able to, like, push on and continue on and get back to making good time. So that was nice. Cause that could have really, like, slowed us down even more. And then I was having trouble staying awake. So, I started relying on Dan again to kind of, like, help. Can you kind of stay back with me a little bit and helped, keep me alert and going. And then as we finished that co-steering section and we're back into town again. We started ticking off the last checkpoints, and I actually got to punch the last checkpoint of the race, which was kind of nice. Chelsea had been punching most of the checkpoints except for ones that were kind of tall. Then I would take the passport for that. And, you know, I've got an extra 2 feet on me, so reach up and check those points.
That's a nice moment. That's a nice symbolic thing for you to do after the, as much as nice for them to have you for the race, and they were very smart and gracious in bringing you along. You had an act of bravery on your part too, right? I mean, you had to have some trepidation going into the race.
Oh yeah, for sure. Like I said, if they hadn't, if I hadn't been able to tell myself at every step of the way that they wanted me to be there, and there was no doubt in my mind, like, they never let any doubt slip into my mind that they wanted to be there. If they had, it would have been a much different race for me, and it would have been much harder. So, like, that's, you know, my mental fortitude, it was what it was, but without their positive attitude, even in the down times, I would have had a much different race.
So now you've gone to co-steering, you're back to, you punched the final checkpoint. So talk us about your finish. How did it feel coming across the finish line?
Pretty disappointing. Not that it wasn't disappointing where we were at. I was very happy with our placement. We ended up being 24th overall, which we knew we were somewhere around there between 25th and 30th. We thought
that was with 90 plus teams. I think there were 96 teams in total.
Yeah, 94, 96 teams, something like that. And a top American team. There was only four American teams, but they're still really competitive teams. It's something to be proud of. And it was just a long slog from that last checkpoint through town. And we kind of got a little bit down, you know, it was like, you know, we'd gone through this beautiful coastline, and then we were walking through graffiti and, traffic that was not expecting people to be there at 3 o'clock in the morning and going a little fast. And it was just kind of a death march into the finish line. And then there was no lights on at the finish, so we weren't sure anyone was even there.
Oh no.
So
sorry.
Yeah.
Oh man, you wanted the marching band, and you wanted the lights on and the spotlights, well, or something, anything. No lights on at finish.
Maybe a sign that said
they had trackers.
Congratulations.
they knew you were coming.
They knew we were coming. Yeah, there was not, like, we wouldn't have, like, you know, other than there was a couple weird tents there, we wouldn't have known it was the world championship finish if a photographer hadn't popped out and taken our photo. And it's not just the volunteers were very nice. They were great. I think they kind of chuckled at us when we asked them to call us a cab immediately. Like, what? Why would we stay around? Like, we asked for food and we got a box that had like 12 oranges in it, two apples and a banana.
And what time of the day was it again?
It was like 3 o'clock in the morning.
I'm just laughing at the absurdity of that. Like, 5 days, 17 hours, you pour yourself into it, and it's like, hey, welcome aboard.
Yeah. So the finish was a little disappointing for us in that it just was like, wah, wah.
Right.
But it was great that, you know, we made it, we were healthy, we were all walking reasonably well across the finish line. You know, I had a bungee tied from the toe of my shoe to my vest to help me not be able to lift my foot up or not need to lift my foot up as much. But other than that, we were walking fine and all healthy, and it was, you know, it was great to make it and to feel accomplished in that way.
Did you guys have money on you for the cab? You had to borrow from the volunteers.
Oh no, we had no. Thankfully, we still had a credit card and several euros with us, so we were fine for the cab. I don't even remember the cab ride back in. I remember getting in the cab, and I remember trying to figure out our key cards for our hostel, and that's, I don't remember the cab ride back very much.
I always think about that first shower after a race like that is just the greatest thing in the world. Just getting clean and getting clean clothes on and getting into a bed is just amazing.
Yeah, it was very nice. Our hostel had really warm, like really hot water, and the beds were cozy, and I got to bunk up in a room with Lars, which is always a hoot. So yeah, it was great to get back into like rest. And we actually didn't, what happened? We didn't go right to sleep. I feel like maybe we slept for a little bit and then popped back up and had breakfast. And, I felt like we didn't get very much sleep on that first day until the evening for whatever reason, but it's all kind of a blur at this point.
Well, it's all the adrenaline and the exhaustion. And so now, your anticlimactic finish aside, mm-hmm. now that you're home and now that you're sitting in your residence and you're kind of reflecting on it, What were your big takeaways from the race? What were the lessons that you really want to share with the world?
You know, I guess the for my takeaway is that if you really want to push yourself and you really want to live a specific lifestyle, like if you go for it and you kind of point your life in that direction, even if it doesn't seem like it's maybe taken off as much as you want or not going the way you want. If you aim yourself in that direction and keep at it, like, then you'll be ready when the time comes. Like my late 20s all the way through my 30s, I'm in my late 30s now, have been kind of like geared not towards adventure racing, but towards adventure athletics. And which is why, like, it wasn't a mistake that I got called up to race with a top US team, you know, for the world championships. Like, it wasn't an accident. It was knowing the right people and just having a specific skill set and working on it and working to improve myself for years and years and years. And then when the time came, like, I was ready. To me, that's something that maybe it's easy to forget. It's easy to get discouraged. If you're working hard and maybe you don't see the results that you want right away. And the same, I've had trouble, finding a team for a long time. I had a team for a little bit when I first started, and then I kind of bounced around, and now I'm on a team again. And I have, Bend Racing that I work with, but it took a long time for those relationships to work themselves out, and they're still working themselves out and they're still growing. And it's all just part of the process. So, same as anything else. If you work hard at something, like, it's going to pay off. And the more you work, the more it pays off.